Okay. So the final talk this afternoon on the Church Turing Thesis will be given by Professor Rohit Parikh, formerly of Boston University's Computer Science Department. But then he moved on and became Einstein Distinguished Professor of Mathematics, Computer Science, and Philosophy, I believe, at the City University of New York, where I was very happy to meet him and become a colleague and student. And he has done many things. He's proved very early theorems on the notion of feasibility in arithmetic. Another thing he did more recently, actually in a philosophy volume, a history of philosophy volume I edited, was to begin developing a notion of social software. So this would be the idea that social algorithms are as important as primary, perhaps he thinks even more primary than in individually implemented algorithms, but he'll say more about that. The question here is there a Church Turing thesis for social algorithms? Let's welcome Rohit.
Well, thank you very much for this great honor. This is a wonderful audience and a wonderful occasion. So I want to talk about something which did in fact concern Turing and which has also concerned many of the speakers here, which is a little bit aside from Turing machines but not unrelated. So let me start by giving credit to some of the people here. All of them are current or former students who have collaborated in various pieces of this work. So I want to start by a simple answer to the question in the title is no. I would say it's not a definite no. I don't see how the enormous variety of social algorithms that arise in ordinary life, that they could be amenable to a single scheme as universal Turing machine would be, but you never know. One could be surprised. So Turing was dealing with this relatively simple situation where he was interested in algorithms which took in numbers or strings as input and producing an output. Whereas social algorithms deal with much more complex inputs, and the output may be something more complex as well. In fact, we saw a social algorithm just last week producing an output which some may have found surprising. So the project of developing a taxonomy of social algorithms is both important and interesting. And of course, I would say that this is an area of which a certain portion has been dominated by economics under the title of mechanism design. But economists generally are not familiar with the kinds of computational and structural issues that arise in complicated procedures. And so I think it's crucial for computer scientists and also philosophers to participate in this enterprise. So social algorithms arise at two levels, individual algorithms and the societal levels. So at the individual level, essentially you are yourself writing a program, and society is working like an operating system which implements the various steps that you carry out. So you carry out a certain step, and then society does something, and then the conditions are created for you to carry out the next step. So now, Amartya Sen points out in Commodities and Capabilities that our reliance on the utility theory is a bit naive. Utility theory goes back to von Neumann Morgenstern in the 40s, and there have been various developments. I would say probably the most spectacular development is due to Savage, who put forward a beautiful theory, but also, as he maybe did not acknowledge, but others did for him, a theory which was wrong, right? Because, and this is something that has been pointed out by various people, especially Kahneman and Tversky, and Kahneman's 2002 Nobel lecture is very much worth looking at. You can see it online, the Nobel website. But in any case, what Amartya Sen is talking about is something a little bit more general than the work that von Neumann Morgenstern started. Here's a quote from him. He says, "I argue in favor of focusing on the capability to function, that is what a person can do or can be, and argue against the more standard concentration on opulence, as in real income estimates, or on utility, as in traditional welfare economic formulations. Insofar as opulence and utility have roles, and they certainly do, these can be seen in terms of their indirect connections with well-being and advantage. In particular, the causal importance of opulence and the evidential importance of utility in various forms such as happiness, desire, fulfillment, and choice." In other words, you want to be happy, but a big part of being happy is being able to do what you want. So for example, you may want to be a great piano player, but at the moment you don't know how to play the piano. So what you need is access to a piano and a piano teacher. So society has to provide opportunities for you to exercise your ability. In other words, society should work as a good operating system. So suppose I'm going from my apartment to a hotel in Chicago, then my schedule will consist of several steps: taking a cab to LaGuardia Airport, checking in, boarding the plane, and then Chicago taking a cab to the hotel. Each step needs to be tested for correctness. For example, supposing the planes are grounded, or supposing there are no cabs to LaGuardia Airport. So each step has to be tested for correctness, and if I don't have a picture ID, I can't board the plane, and it's irrelevant that the other steps would have gone well. Now, the schedule I described is a simple straight line program. Do this, then that, then that, then that. There could also be decision points like take a taxi if available, otherwise take a bus. So then the straight line program branches, and if there are several branches, you're going to get a tree rather than just a line. But the entire schedule does have to be checked for correctness, something that we do informally. But other social procedures, like organizing a conference, like this one, as I'm sure the organizers realize, or a wedding can be far more complex. We can invite Aunt Betsy only if her ex-husband Eric has said he cannot come, because the last thing we want is a fight at the wedding. So one role which society can play in our lives is to serve as an operating system within which we can write our individual programs. And when society builds a bridge or starts a bus line, it increases our capabilities and thereby increases our well-being. So well-being shouldn't be thought of just as something passive, something that society gives us, or a safety net or something like that. It's also an apparatus to exercise our own ability so we can do things we want. So I think that the point that Sen makes is a completely straightforward point, and yet it's not often enough met in the discussions. So generally speaking, when society provides us with more subroutines, then at a purely decision theoretic level, we are better off, we can do more things. But at a game theoretic level, we could be worse off because there are other agents who may also utilize the same capabilities in ways which we don't like. So for instance, there was no spam before internet. So internet provided us with opportunities, but it also provided other people opportunities to send us spam. Or there were no drive-by shootings before there were motorcycles and cars and guns. So when people acquire more abilities, you yourself as a decision maker are better off, but some people with different goals can see to it that you're worse off. So it's a trade-off. Now, there is a second level beyond the individual level, and that's the level which is somewhat more important. So a social planner wants to achieve some social goal, and he needs to be aware that the plan can only succeed if the various individuals act in a manner which is consonant with the plan. So let's suppose that Romney has a plan to cut taxes, and then he anticipates that a lot of people will hire a lot of people. He's not going to force these people to hire other people, but he is anticipating that that's what they will do, and then he needs a theory of whether they will actually hire more people or put money to Switzerland or whatever, right? So his plan depends in a certain sense on the individual plans of, he sets up the operating system and the other people carry out the little routines, and the global effect of that can be something not anticipated. So the trick is to see that what they do on their own coincides with what the plan requires. Now, their actions can be influenced either by influencing their beliefs or their possibilities of action or their desires. And the last is harder, but advertisers do it all the time through advertising, and of course, under radical circumstances, can be done through brainwashing. Okay, now here's a first example, and this is an example due to Shakespeare, who anticipated many things, and before him other things were anticipated even by Plato. So at Messina, a messenger brings news that Don Pedro, a Spanish prince from Aragon, and his officers Claudio and Benedict have returned from a successful battle. Leonardo, the governor of Messina, welcomes the messenger and announces that Don Pedro and his men will stay for a month. Being Italians, they're happy about this. So Beatrice, Leonardo's niece, asks the messenger about Benedict and makes sarcastic remarks about his ineptitude as a soldier. So Leonardo explains that there is a kind of merry war betwixt Signor Benedict and her. Various events take place, and Claudio wins the hand in marriage of Hero, Leonardo's only daughter, and the wedding is to take place in a week. Now, Don Pedro and his men, bored at the prospect of waiting for a week for the wedding, hatch a plan to matchmake between Beatrice and Benedict, who inwardly love each other, but outwardly display contempt for each other. In other words, their love is defensive and it's expressed through these sarcastic comments which each makes against the other. So according to the stratagem, the men led by Don Pedro proclaim Beatrice's love for Benedict while knowing he's eavesdropping on their conversation. So they arrange it in such a way that he thinks he's eavesdropping on a conversation, but in fact the conversation is a charade carried out for his benefit. So we have, if I use B for Benedict and D for Don Pedro and E for the event of eavesdropping, then KBE, which means Benedict is aware of the eavesdropping, he's doing it. Don Pedro is aware of the eavesdropping, he arranged it, but Benedict does not know that Don Pedro knows about E. So this complicated state of knowledge is arrived at through this stratagem of putting on a charade, which where he thinks he's spying, but in fact they know that he's spying. So all these conditions are essential, and of course the plot would be spoiled if Benedict knew that Don Pedro was aware that he was eavesdropping, because then he would suspect that this was a charade put on his benefit. So Benedict would be suspicious and would not credit the conversation. And similarly, the women led by Hero carry on a similar charade for Beatrice. And so Beatrice and Benedict are now convinced that their own love is returned and hence decide to requite the love of the other. And the play ends with all four lovers getting married. There is also a complicated subplot having to do with Don Pedro's brother, but we can put that aside. So here is Benedict's decision problem put in conventional game theoretic terms. So there are two conditions, love and no love, love being the condition that Beatrice loves him, and no love being the condition that Beatrice does not love him, and he has two actions, propose and no propose. Now, if he proposes and she loves him, wonderful, they get married. If he proposes but she doesn't love him, then he will only encounter more sarcasm, and so his payoff will be -20, negative. On the other hand, if he doesn't propose, but she does love him, then he has lost an opportunity, so there also the payoff is negative. And if he doesn't propose, she doesn't love him, payoff is zero. So given the condition that if he believes that she doesn't love him, then his dominant strategy is not to propose. If he knows that she loves him, his dominant strategy is to propose. And so Don Pedro and his men arrange for the game to move from the right column to the left column. And they do this by means of this knowledge stratagem. So by influencing Benedict's beliefs, Don Pedro influenced his choice. And Shakespeare, by the way, also supplies an example of a philosophical fact noticed after him by Gettier, but also much before by Shakespeare, by Plato, and in between Russell also noticed this phenomenon, that justified true belief is not knowledge. Now, there is a connection between an issue which Turing faces in his classical 1936 paper and an issue which Socrates faces in Plato's dialogue, Theaetetus, and if I have time, I'll come back to discussing this, because I've noticed that several speakers have touched on this very issue faced by Turing, which was, in a sense, anticipated by Socrates. It's a little out of the way, and for the moment, I'll say nothing more about it. Now, inducing false beliefs in the tigers of the Sundarbans. So the Sundarbans are an area at the border of India and Bangladesh where lush forests grow and tiger attacks on humans have been common. Because there are lots of poor people who live in that area and they go to cut wood in the forest, the tigers are aware of all the people coming. Now, normally tigers are not man-eaters, they prefer to eat animals, but in this situation, because there are so many helpless humans who go there to cut wood and there are so many tigers, tiger attacks are very common. So fishermen and bushmen then created masks made to look like faces to wear on the back of their heads because tigers always attack from behind. So this worked for a short time. So the tiger is about to attack a man, but he's wearing this mask at the back of his head. And he says, oh my God, this man is facing me. I better not attack. So what happened was that in 1987, no one wearing a mask was killed by a tiger, but 29 people not wearing masks were killed. So this was another kind of knowledge stratagem, where the tigers were induced to have a false belief that the man was facing them, and they left the men alone, at least for a while. Unfortunately, the tigers eventually realized it was a hoax, and their attacks resumed. So how do we create knowledge states? Now, creating knowledge states is something that has now become something of an industry. There is some work done by Jan Plaza, who got his doctorate from CUNY, Melvin Fitting was not your student, right? Melvin Fitting?
No. He was Smalley's.
Pardon me?
He was Smalley's.
Smalley's student, right. But a student of Mel Fitting, but I influenced him in this area. And then there are other people in Amsterdam and elsewhere who work on the question of how is state of knowledge influenced when something happens. Somebody says something, somebody whispers something to somebody, and so on and so forth. Because as we saw, what people believe or what people know determines what they do. And therefore, you can influence what they do by influencing what they know. So a state, what we showed, this is done by myself and two students, Chao Tastemir and Andreas Witzel, is that a state of knowledge S can be created among a finite number of agents by a single interval of signals sent to them by an agent. And how is this done? I'll give a simple example. So let's look at this Kripke structure with three states. State 1, where P is true. State 2, where P is also true. And state 3, where P is false. Now, agent A cannot distinguish between 1 and 2, but it doesn't matter, because as far as he's concerned, P is true in both states, so he knows P. Agent P cannot distinguish between 2 and 3. P is true at 2 and is false at 3. So from his point of view, P is not always true, P is not always false. He doesn't know that P is true. Moreover, because agent A does not know whether the state is 1 or 2, he doesn't know whether B knows. Because if it was state 2, then B would not know. If it was state 1, then B would know. So agent A doesn't know that B doesn't know. Okay, now we can achieve this situation by sending a pair of signals to both A and B. Each signal contains a description of the Kripke structure, this whole picture. And as a second part of each signal, A is told that the real world is 1 of 1 and 2, and B is told that the real world is 1 of 2 and 3. So 2 is the actual world, and both of them are told the truth, but they are told partial truth, and the state of knowledge they arrive at is one where A knows, B doesn't know, and A doesn't know that B doesn't know. Now, of course, tigers do not understand Kripke structures, so some other methods must be used for them. And in Bangladesh, of course, they use this alternative method. And anyway, it seems that they cannot achieve arbitrary states of knowledge. It's most implausible that they can, but the question of whether tigers or chimps or dolphins or even corvids achieve complicated states of knowledge or not, this is very much an open question. So it's probably impossible to convince tiger A that tiger B does not know that tiger C knows that there is a hunter with a gun behind the rock. But Jim Corbett might disagree, because he was the author of Man-Eaters of Kumaon. Trying to eat man-eaters, he discovered again and again that they were outwitting him. Eventually, of course, he managed to kill a tiger, but it took a great deal of effort, great deal of ingenuity, and he could not always be sure of success. Okay, now here is a problem that I worked on with Amy Greenwald, who now teaches at Brown. So this problem is known as the Santa Fe Bar problem, is due to Brian Arthur. And the problem is as follows. There is a particular finite population of people in New Mexico, and every Thursday night, all of these people want to go to the El Farol Bar. However, the El Farol is quite small, and it's no fun to go there if it's crowded. So much so, in fact, that the preferences of the population can be described as follows. If less than 60% go to the bar, they'll all have a better time than if they stayed at home. If more than 60% go to the bar, they'll all have a worse time than they stayed at home. Now, let's suppose that all these people already have the full records of what happened on previous nights, previous Thursdays, with the, how many people went, how many people didn't go, and so on and so forth. And on the basis of this data, they arrive at a theory. Now, the paradox is that this theory cannot be known and correct. Because if this theory is known, then if the theory says it won't be crowded, everyone will go and the bar will be crowded. If the theory is correct and it predicts that the bar will be crowded, no one will go and the bar will not be crowded. So the theory is a self-defeating theory. Now, to see that it's a variant of the Russell paradox, just imagine that there is only one person involved, and crowded means there is at least one person at the bar. So in that case, a person makes the bar crowded by going there, and if he doesn't go there, the bar is not crowded. So, but with many people, it looks a little bit more dramatic. So you can see that the way in which people reason and they arrive at their states of knowledge can affect their behavior, whether they go to the bar or whether they don't go to the bar, or whether the tire attacks this person or doesn't. Now, this is a kind of an aside on the theory of mind, having to do with the fact that the ability to reason about the behavior of other people develops gradually, and here is a story. So this is a story by two Austrian psychologists, Wimmer and Perner. Other people have done similar experiments. So Maxi goes out shopping with his mother, and when they come back, Maxi helps mother put away the groceries, which include chocolate. There are two cupboards, red and blue. Maxi puts the chocolate in the red cupboard and goes out to play. When Maxi is gone, mother takes the chocolate out of the red cupboard, uses some of it to bake a cake, and then puts the rest in the blue cupboard. Okay, now Maxi comes back from play and wants the chocolate. Okay, Maxi is not a real person. He's a character in a story, but the story is told to a bunch of little children, or maybe even enacted in front of them. Where will Maxi look for the chocolate? He put it in the red cupboard, then he went out to play. Mother moved it to the blue cupboard. He comes back, he wants the chocolate. Children at the age of 5 or more say, in the red cupboard, because they know he put it there. But children up to the age of 3 or 4 say, Maxi will look in the blue cupboard. They know the chocolate is in the blue cupboard. Why would he look elsewhere? So what three-year-old children lack, according to psychologists Primack and Woodruff, is a theory of mind. And then, of course, there's the question whether tigers have a theory of mind, chimps have a theory of mind, and to what extent. Okay, now I'm running out of time, or how long do I?
You could take a couple more minutes. The okay. Coffee break is,
pardon me?
The coffee break is at 4.
So I see. Okay.
We started a bit later.
So. All right. So I have something to say about elections, but I'll skip that, and I'll just... So do animals have a theory of mind? And here is an experiment that's performed with two chimps. The chimp at the bottom, the thoughtful one, is the subordinate chimp, and the chimp at the top with the sharp teeth is the dominant one. And the dominant one will not let the subordinate one eat if he sees it. So now the subordinate chimp sees these two pieces of food that are bananas. The bananas on the right are visible to the dominant chimp, and the bananas on the left are hidden by a barrier, which you can also see. And in experiments, typically the subordinate chimp goes to the bananas on the left, which he knows that the other one cannot see. And now the question is, does he have a theory of what the other one does or will do, what he's thinking, and so on and so forth? We don't know. So, the time is passing, so let me simply say this particular remark about Plato and Turing. And this is something that I came across only very recently, because I was studying the Theaetetus, right? Now, in the Theaetetus, Socrates raises the question of what is knowledge. And he's carrying out a discussion with this young boy called Theaetetus, who is 16 years old. And the first offer that Theaetetus made is, knowledge is perception. This is undermined after discussion. And the second one is, knowledge is true belief. This is also undermined after a certain amount of discussion. And then the boy offers a third explanation. Knowledge is true belief with an explanation. Right? Now, in other words, knowledge is justified true belief. Now, this account was challenged by Gettier in a very, very well-known paper written in 1963. He says, let's suppose that I'm told that my friend, let's say, Juliet, is going to get a job. And she and I in the office are the person who is going to make the decision. Right? Now, I have good reason to believe that Juliet is going to get the job, and therefore I have good reason to believe that she will get a job, and moreover, I have good reason to believe that there is somebody in that office who is going to get that job. In fact, the person who is going to get the job is me. And so my belief that somebody is going in the office is going to get a job is justified because it came via Juliet. But on the other hand, it's not knowledge because the justification itself fails even though it's completely understandable. So this was Gettier's argument. But Socrates offers a much more sophisticated argument. He says, consider my name and the first syllable of my name, which is S-O. And now if somebody asks to explain the spelling of the first two syllables, he will say it's S and then followed by O. So that's an explanation of the first syllable. Socrates says, fine, but if knowledge is justified true belief, what is the justification of the letter S? If you have no justification for letter S, then you don't have knowledge of letter S, and if you don't have knowledge of letter S, then you don't have knowledge of the syllable. So according to Socrates, the theory justified true belief fails because it cannot account for the atomic actions. Now, Turing in his paper, in his 1936 paper, implicitly faces this issue because he is asked why the alphabet of the Turing machine should be finite. And he says if the alphabet was infinite, it would not be possible to distinguish the different symbols clearly. He also says for the same reason that the states of mind must be finite, because if they are infinite, then different states of mind would be close to each other and might get confused. So he faces the same problem, which is, how is an atomic action to be carried out? You see, if I have a string, if I have a Turing program which is presented the string A, B, C, B, A, and asked if it's a palindrome, then of course it can carry out the reading of the string, but in order to carry out the string, it has to recognize the symbol A. And so the atomic action still has to be justified. It's justified, and of course we all do it, but in an ordinary context, in a human context, the atomic actions are not always done uniformly by everybody, and therefore that gap has to be filled somehow. And Wittgenstein addresses this issue. I won't go into that, and I will thank you for listening.
There are some questions. Is that a hand in the back?
No.
Any questions?
Yeah.
So what does Wittgenstein say about grounding atomic actions?
Yes. He says explanations come to an end somewhere. No, but my understanding of Wittgenstein, which Juliet can challenge, but my understanding is that we live in a community in which certain atomic actions are taken for granted as a part of being in the community. So we all take it for granted that we all recognize the letter S. And Socrates points out that perception is not knowledge, because a pig could see the letter S but wouldn't know it was the letter S. So it's not something that's self-justifying. It's justified because we belong to a community in which we all do it aloud. You have a question?
No questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
I'm trying to ask a question. So you must have reason to be social
knowledge and social norm. I see. The connection between knowledge and social norm.
Yeah.
Well, one thing, of course, is that in order for you to obey social norm, you have to know the conditions as such that the social norm will be obeyed. For example, if a child is drowning, you have the obligation to rescue the child.
but only if you're able to see the child, and only if you're able to, only if you know that other people aren't there who could be better swimmers than you. So there is a connection between knowledge and carrying out a social norm, because the conditions for you to carry out the norm have to be there, and you have to know those conditions. Was that your question? Or
yeah.
You?
Do you see an extension of this so-called crowdsourced knowledge that is so common?
Crowdsourced
information. Crowdsourced.
The wisdom of the crowds?
Cloud or crowd?
Crowdsourced.
Wisdom of the crowds.
Right, right. This actually goes back to a theorem of Condorcet called the jury theorem. And the theorem is that if you have a number of independent agents, and let's say you have a large number of agents, and each one has only a 51% probability of being right, then the probability that the majority is right is overwhelming. It will be very, very close to one, right? And I believe there is a recent book with the title, The Wisdom of the Crowds. But it's important that the agents be independent, because we have this other phenomenon, what's called the knowledge cascade, right? Where you tell her something, right? Your neighbor something, right? She has been wondering, but you tell her with some confidence. And so she decides to agree. And then the person next to her now has two people who believe the same thing, and the cascades can start. And so a lot of people acquire the same view, which in fact is very little basis in evidence. This can happen. So it's very important that the opinions be arrived at independently. And therefore, my recommendation would be always read newspapers of different political persuasions. Don't read the same.
On that note,
is that where you were going to go for the election results?
No, it was essentially a theory having to do with truth assignments and a certain kind of business function. But it would take at least 20 minutes to explain.
Thank you very much.